Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
His eyes soften as he watches Yezi sing a Chinese folk song with subtle feminine movement. The room fills with laughter when Ellie Wang unabashedly enacts her vulgar bodily desires. What is the affect created through these performances? At different localities and temporalities, an actress and a comedian, Tan Wei and Ellie Wang, embody ever-failing meaning of Chineseness, offering themselves for both consumption and survival. In Vulgar Beauty, Mila Zhu reevaluates beauty to understand how it creates a feeling of Chineseness, engendering a messy world of relationalities that challenge a stable binary of national identity. Using Wei Dao, which escapes meaning in English as flavor and style of a person, object, or environment, Zuo challenges the Cartesian epistemology dividing mind-body and vision-hearing. Through in-depth analysis of films and shows, Zuo asks how five flavors of Chinese medicine, bitter, salty, pungent, sweet, and sour, become, quote, modalities of vulgar beauty. Vulgar, often tied to the non-Western and the working-class bodies, become a means to complicate the relations between objecthood and subjecthood embodied in Chinese beauty. I am pleased to welcome Professor Mila Zhu today at the New Books Network in Gender Studies to talk about her new work, Vulgar Beauty, Acting Chinese in Global Sensorium. Mila, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it is such a pleasure to have you, and I'm so excited to talk about your new book. First, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Prior to this, I taught at Oregon State University in Corvallis. I received my PhD in cinema and media studies at UCLA. And I came to write this book, I guess it started in graduate school when I really wanted to grapple with cinematic identification and understand how we might construct and understand our social selves in relation to popular images. So film spectators are always kind of engaged in a kind of splitting of perceptual attention, you know, sort of between absence and presence. And when you think about with the regard to, about the self and the other. But I think there's a further dimension to this when we consider the racialization and sexualization of subjects. So the splitting and the suturing with the cinematic image also occurs with an awareness of racialized, sexualized difference. And that's what I'm really interested in. So in my early academic career, I sought out transnational Chinese cinemas. And I wanted to interrogate also at the same time, Western depictions of Chinese femininity. In my dissertation, I looked at the ways in which Chinese femininity converged with embodied ideas of sexuality, health and well-being in these transnational cinemas. But my book, in some ways, continues this line of inquiry, but is more, I think, rooted in theoretical and philosophical concepts to think about the affective phenomenon of beauty and its performative implications across different social, geopolitical, and cultural contexts.
Thank you so much for sharing with us the genealogy of your research. And I think one of the things that I most identified with when I was reading your book was that how, you know, in a way you also shared your personal story as well, especially with the first chapter on Gong Li and how your you know, on compared you to Gong Li, and you know, in thinking about this like racialized and like sexualized depiction, and you know, the affect created through that, and you know, its relations to geopolitical and historical factors, which I just found really interesting. So I'm really excited to talk about that. I think more later when we talk about different chapters, but. First, I wanted to go over some key terms as a context for the audience. Can you define for us acting Chinese and vulgar beauty?
Yes. So acting Chinese is one of the terms that I use when I'm working within star studies, thinking about the ways in which star images circulate as aspirational images, right? Both in terms of conspicuous consumption, as has been written about, but also in kind of the minute gestural ways that we understand what it means to be a person, what it means to be a human, and what it means to have charm and charisma as people. And so when I'm thinking about acting Chinese, I'm thinking about the social performativity of an assumed or projected racial, ethnic, or cultural identity. And I love what you said that this always failing meaning of Chineseness, because I'm also taking Chineseness as an unstable or flexible signifier, not least because of the very fraught ways in which we, of course, approach the geopolitical, cultural, linguistic diversities and contestations within the so-called identity. And so I want to, I'm qualifying the ways I'm addressing this identity with the idea of acting to suggest that what these on-screen performances reveal to us is that there's a pretense and a play in this identity. That identity is not a static object, even as there are stereotypes and archetypes that seek to rigidify such an identity within a given or racial ethnic identity. But acting Chinese, I think, honors both the filmic component of what I'm thinking about here with regard to global Chinese women film stars, as well as the everyday social performativity of Chinese subjects. And as a diasporic subject in particular, you know, I wonder that the vacillations and disparities between the two, you know, self-imposed identity or one that's projected by others, these are keenly kind of felt in an estranging way. The other part of acting Chinese is that I'm looking at, of course, kind of voluntary behaviors. But in particular, what I want to look at is the minor act, the way that somebody holds their body, their gaze, the clothing that they wear, how they touch their hair, these really small movements. These work in concert with the environment, the objects that surround these bodies. They're all taken in as an entire scene of that person. So right, when I talk about Gong Li, it's like this fire that burns behind her conveys this kind of interiority of bitter ressentiment. Or, you know, in the sweet chapter, I talk about the pitter-patter of rain on the roof. It mimics this Vivian Xu's crying in the scene, these campy, almost crocodile tears. And you see this mimicry or this the way in which the environment is also part of the performance, right? And this is what I want to be attuned to when I'm thinking about acting Chinese. And I think, I'm sorry, I've talked for so long. Did you ask also about vulgar beauty as a concept?
Yeah, also about vulgar beauty as well. Yeah.
Okay. So vulgar beauty then is a concept that I offer as a means to address this specific racialized charisma that I'm thinking about with Chinese or Asian women in particular. So with on vulgarity, I want to discuss and undo sort of the ocular centrisms of Western epistemologies, of continental philosophy and film studies. Vision and hearing have long been privileged as dominant ways of knowing, right? While taste and scent and touch were degraded as primitive and or feminine sensorial ways of knowing, lesser ways of knowing. But we can also think about this idea of the psychoanalytic notion of part objects, which involve fragments of the body that lack a specular image. And through those, like Carol Maver connects scent with the body of the mother. And she talks about why scent has been marginalized in Freudian conceptions. But in recent decades, there's really a turn towards thinking about embodiment in a more holistic way. And in film studies, in sensing cinema through a kind of synesthesia, where you are consuming in every sensorial register as you're viewing a film, hearing a film. And I'm building off of the work by Vivian Sobchak, Laura E. Marks, Jennifer Barker, among others. So vulgar beauty for me is a way to recognize the ways in which affects or these kinds of part objects, partial objects, emerge to the lower sensorium, and particularly through taste, to structure the ways in which we encounter women stars, each of whom I suggest becomes famous because of a particular way that their embodied performativity seems to reflect a kind of social rupture. So ultimately, I'm rehabilitating vulgarity. I'm rehabilitating the lower sensorium to try to make sense of beauty through these different flavors. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your really beautiful elucidation of the two concepts. And I think both just really spoke to me and to my own research interest regarding acting Chinese and thinking about flexible signifier. I wonder if you watched Kim's Convenience.
I've only seen a little bit of the first episode. Can you tell me about it?
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking a lot about the show and in a way, like mixed reception, especially from Korean immigrant community, like an older Korean immigrant community, especially my mom actually found the show to be kind of insulting in its, depiction of Korean Americans as well as their accent, because she thought that it was actually quite inaccurate. And it was, most of the characters were actually played by Korean Americans who spoke like quote unquote like perfect English. Also thinking, and then later, Sima Liu talked about how even though the writer was technically Korean American, actually most of the producers were white. So kind of thinking about in a way, we kind of want to acknowledge like the flexible signifier, but also like the interplay between maybe like the dominant, in a way, mainstream reception versus like the immigrant, reception, and the way that this depiction felt like really jarring. Because I mean, they were acting Korean, but it was like constantly failing them was really interesting for me. And I also loved what you said about the environment as well. You know, and then how these like voluntary behaviors and minor acts that, you know, are really like connected to the interaction with the objects and the environment. And that made me actually think a lot about, and then someone that you also talk about a lot, Anne Chang and her book on ornamentalism. So I actually wanted to ask you whether, you know, you could talk more about abject epistemology and how, you know, you kind of integrate this like theory by Sedgwick on vulgar as reparative practices to, in a way, rethink what it means to be an object and objecthood.
Yes. So yeah, Eve Sedgwick writes beautifully about reparative or weak theory against the currents of strong paranoid hermeneutics. And I love what she says. There's a line about camp and the overattachment to fragmentary, marginal waste leftovers and how that produces new lines of thinking and embracing and being attuned to the object. Susan Sontag also relates camp to good digestion and says that without it, a man of good taste might be chronically frustrated or constipated. And so it's really interesting that, and these I connect very much with taste and with kind of vulgar attachments. So not only, for example, you brought up Ali Wong. So Ali Wong, in a very straightforward way, talks about her bodily waste. She talks about shitting and her vaginal discharge and all of this kind of vulgar, all of these what might be deemed vulgar topics. But I kind of unpack that. I kind of rehabilitate that in terms of thinking through the carnivalesque as subversive kinds of embodiments. So there's one way where I'm dealing with the abject and the vulgar in a very literal way, I guess. But I'm also thinking about abject epistemologies in the sense that I'm sort of holding up sensorial epistemologies and vernacular understandings and elevating them to the status of philosophy. So these kind of subjugated knowledges, which is a word that Foucault uses, is related to what I call the abject because they've been excluded from dominant hegemonic modes of knowledge, knowledge production. But I want to think through these. I'm not revering any mode above any other, but I'm interested in their interrelationality and how these discourses, how these multiple ways of how these multiple epistemologies are speaking to each other across time, across different languages, across different cultures. So in this way, I think by rehabilitating the abject, I can see how my work could sit alongside other work that critically interrogates objecthood, like Anne Anlin Chang's work, which I'm also really inspired by and find really useful. Her book Ornamentalism thinks about the ways in which Asiatic femininity has long been conflated with synthetic objecthood. And she offers quite an interesting take on object-oriented ontology, which is otherwise really dominated by universalist claims that doesn't really pay attention to identity and certainly seems to brush aside racial identity, for example. And she really puts pressure, right, on that philosophical mode of thinking by introducing the idea of race and femininity. And so for me, I also want to trouble these binaries of subject and object. I think that taste, by thinking about it as this transcendent affective quality, and in particular by thinking about different flavors as different experiential objects that we commune with when we engage with mediated bodies, that this is another way to bring our thinking towards objecthood and objectivity and intersubjectivity, interobjectivity together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I loved what you said about how your book is, thinking about abject epistemology as sensorial, and in a way bringing these lesser partial knowledges, as they were called, such as like taste, scent, feeling, to the status of philosophy. Like, I thought that it was really beautifully done in the book. And also, I think you reflect on in the introduction when you quote Foucault and, you know, what he says about subjugated knowledges, how, you know, it's important to not just in a way simply then valorize subjugated knowledges, but rather, you know, really think about like why and how, you know, we're, you know, utilizing some of the insights. And, you know, for your book in particular, you know, you're engaging with Chinese concepts, such as Weidao and Sajiao. Like, I don't speak Chinese, so I'm sure that I am butchering the pronunciation. But I also wanted to ask you, you know, why you decided to use, you know, these two concepts. And also, when we think about translation, you know, because like translation is often slippery, and, you know, that is actually part of your work as well, right? In terms of thinking about acting Chinese, the slipperiness of signifier, you know, that's also kind of embodied in the translational work that is being done. So yeah, I wanted to ask you, you know, why you decided to use the concept the way now, and also, you know, what you think about like translation and how the slipperiness applies in your own work.
Yes, thank you for those beautiful questions. So I guess I felt that we were missing frames and we were missing language through which to really unpack the phenomena of beauty, which I argue is an elusive object, even as it asserts itself upon us with a kind of immediacy and even a kind of shock of the signified or the real. And aesthetic theory seems really uncomfortable with beauty. Just thinking about a sort of Kantian genealogy, you know, anything that pleases is a dumb object, and it's not really valuable as an object for contemplation. And there's a kind of binary between beauty and sublime. But Kant still insists that there's this universal quality about beauty. And so I wanted to kind of trouble some of these ideas while making a distinction, sort of cultural distinction, but also a distinction between charm and charisma. Charm, I argue, is pleasing and it attempts to recede from view. I analogize this with sweetness. But charisma is forceful and it's more insistent. It's more like the bad tastes that I deal with and therefore aligns more with what I'm thinking about with vulgar beauty. And so It's a complex subject, but I'm introducing flavor as a way to kind of deal with kind of the discomfort and to give us more language in aesthetic theory, to give us more language about embodied beauty. Otherwise, you know, from a strictly Foucauldian point of view, beauty is part of a biopolitical regime that oppresses us, right? It's unevenly, unfairly distributed. And all of this might be true, absolutely. But what my book wants to think through is this kind of also this absolute power that beauty has on us, a priori to its social and cultural meanings, even as later we do attach cultural, racialized, sexualized meanings. And so for me, getting to Weidao, getting to flavor as an analytic helps me think about these different affective chords of beauty, while not dismissing the impact, but it gives us a little bit more nuance. And so I stumbled across Weidao when I came across a passage in a Chinese book that talked about Zhang Yimou's first impression of Gong Li. So he was a director that she was involved with, both professionally and personally. He said he cast her because of her Weidao, which he described as a bitter, spicy kind of personality. And I was really intrigued by this. And my parents also used this term before to talk about personality, to talk about style. And I couldn't find, an exact English translation There isn't a one-to-one correspondence here. And so I found that thinking about flavor, you know, at first I was like, oh no, thinking about flavors, that's too gimmicky. But when I started looking more into Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine and thinking about Chinese philosophy and thinking about cosmologies, it gave me this very capacious framework when basically you can think about flavors as having lateral relationships with other phenomena, events, and objects. And what it allows me to think about is not only the performativity, you know, a bitter performance, but it allows me also to think about on the spectator side as well, the impact of that affect. And these five flavors in Chinese medicine and in Chinese food are intended to treat various symptoms. So you might eat bitterness to treat a bitter ailment in the heart. So it's kind of interesting to think about flavorful beauty as acting as a kind of cultural medicine or an antidote to address a social or political or historical ailment as well. And I just thought that was kind of a rich way to get us past a kind of either universalist, categorical idea of beauty or to condemn the biopolitics of beauty.
Yeah. Well, that was really beautifully said. And I especially love how, in a way, you bring the analogy of, you know, five flavors being used to treat like various symptoms as like cultural healing, to in a way complicate this notion of beauty as like biopolitical too. So kind of expanding that framework. And, you know, I'm not really like a Japan scholar, so, you know, this is kind of more about lay knowledge, but what you were saying about beauty was also making me think about how in Japanese the word kawaii, you know, which is used so often, is not only about cuteness but then also about vulgarity as well, because kawaii also actually means like grotesque as well. Japanese people then think about the grotesque as like cute and like its appeal through like many senses. And I was also kind of reading about how blackened teeth, like twisted blackened teeth used to be considered like kawaii in Japan as well. So also kind of like thinking about how that involves like, you know, like different senses maybe, even though I don't really know about this in a scholarly level, but this is like making me, you know, like connect to like these like different conceptions of beauty and how that in a way really challenges like the Kantian notion of, you know, beauty. Yeah. So it's really, really interesting. And I wanted to then now kind of, now that we were able to kind of set the framework for the audience about the book and like some of the main, terminologies and the theoretical frameworks that were used in this book, I kind of wanted to now then really go into the analysis part, because, you know, that's really fun. That part is really fun. So, you know, you define the five flavors in Chinese medicine: bitter, salty, pungent, sweet, and sour, and you look at different films and shows to talk about it. So we already talked about Gong Li, but I wanted to, you know, further ask you, whether you would like to share with the audience about, you know, Gong Li and why you describe her as embittered beauty.
Sure. So bitterness, I'm really looking not only at the kind of Chinese traditional medicinal connotations, what I suggested earlier, there's a kind of homeopathic logic that like cures like. But Deleuze, when he talks about Nietzsche, is also points out that Nietzsche, in his writing about bitterness and suffering, and I call him like the prime philosopher of bitterness in the West, he's also suggesting something similar, which I find really interesting, that, you know, bitterness cures bitterness, that bitterness will treat bitterness. And so with Gong Li, she's the first global film star after Mao's death in the post-Mao era. And she really embodies a bitter reckoning with China's past, in particular, the kind of recent memories of the Cultural Revolution, some of which gets displaced onto pre-revolutionary feudal times as in a kind of analogy or in a way to displace the criticism, I guess. So I'm tracking in particular her work with Zhang Yimou. Of course, Zhang is the one who points out her spicy Wei Dao and this bombast that she has, this swagger that she has. She often plays the victim in her early career in Zhang's films, but she does it with such this kind of strength and this eroticized kind of bitterness. So she sensualizes what it means to feel bitter about history, which is really quite beautiful. But then in the Western films, though, like a film like Hannibal Rising, we see that her racial flavor takes on kind of different notes. Bell Hooks, in her essay Eating the Other, talks about how racial others are used to spice up an otherwise bland, you know, white mainstream dish. And so thinking about this particular film, which is about the famous cinematic cannibal Hannibal Lecter of Silence of the Lambs, Gong in this film, in this origin story, plays an exotic Japanese woman, and she's said to deodorize the men's traumatic memory of the Holocaust. And so here there's another reckoning with the past, with a historical trauma, but the bitterness of her raciality seeps through in the film's attempt to taste her continually, and the diegetic male characters in particular, which we see again and again, both want to taste her and both are have this anxiety, this very excessive pleasure in the form of disgust. And then so there I analyze this particular insult about her that reduces her to her genitalia and talks about this kind of deviant genitalia. It's very sensorial. And it analogizes her body with these dead pig carcasses that are hanging up in a food stall. So the Asian woman here is both odorless and foul, and occupying this particular bitterness in both, you know, the Chinese and the Western imaginaries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I loved your analysis, and also in a way thinking about, you know, the translational work that is also happening between, you know, the Western and the Chinese films, and also how it, you know, that really speaks to this troubling of binary when we think about objecthood, biopolitical, you know, and healing, you know, effect that has in Gong Li essentializing, you know, performances that in a way is about being eaten, but then also in a way about like reckoning with the past. Like, I love that, you know, the complexity that was really shown in this chapter. Yeah. And about Moving on to salty part of your chapter, as a Korean Canadian who kind of grew up with the dominant discourse about multiculturalism, I also really found this chapter to be very interesting when you talked about immigrant materiality and your focus on Maggie Chung and Joanne Chen to in a way look at the uneasy consolidation of national identity. Can you tell us more about this particular chapter and how you talk about immigrant materiality?
Sure. So with Salt, I was really intrigued to find material semiotic understandings of the substance in what's called alchemical psychology. So students of Carl Jung, like James Hillman, but especially because I found it intriguing that Jungian psychoanalysis has been so overshadowed and eclipsed by Freud and Lacan. It's also a kind of abject epistemology, especially in film studies. So I really wanted to think through the ways in which these kind of psychoanalysts were thinking about Salt. So they're dealing both with their material substance, but connecting them to a kind of cosmological understanding. But what I found interesting was this idea of salt as requiring the right dosage, and it being a kind of post-bitter state. And of course, we need salt for nerve and muscular functions, but we cannot. So we cannot produce it. We import it, and it's an object that we bring inside. Nevertheless, there is something dubious about saltiness. And I talk about like MSG as a kind of a cultural stigmatized version of salt. But there's also the kind of colloquialism of taking things with a pinch or a grain of salt. So it's like imported, but there's also a kind of doubt and suspicion around that. And I feel that with these kind of immigrant subjects, in these particular films, that ambivalence is really pronounced. So I'm looking at Irma Vep, Olivier Assayas' Irma Vep, starring Maggie Chung, and David Lynch's TV series Twin Peaks, starring Joan Chen. And in both, these women are there in a way to tell these ostensible tales of Western liberal multiculturalism, which is about a kind of racial balance in a post-Cold War environment. But the suspicion towards these women are also become narrativized, and you see these minor acts of negotiation that these women perform to self-preserve, which is of course another connotation of salt, this kind of preservation. And here I just wanted to return to something that you've asked about, the translation and slipperiness. Not only am I thinking about translations across different cultures and linguistic contexts, but there's a slipperiness that I embrace in a kind of deconstructive work that is that I'm embracing here, that is between, the vernacular, between the material, and between the philosophical, and these slippages that I find really generative for thinking about flavors. So it seems like I'm kind of hopping between, salt. What is the salt? Like when we taste the salt, what is it? It's sort of a muted substance that exalts existing flavor, and then thinking across to multiculturalism and thinking across about the immigrant subject as brought in to highlight the West's toleration. Look, we've opened the doors to these women, therefore we have this healthy sense of a vision of image of multiculturalism, but not quite, right? Because there's these little ruptures, these tensions that erupt through the text. And so both of these women in these two films engage in minor acts of kind of deflection, self-preservation, and they bring out the envious connotations as well of saltiness. Yeah.
Yeah. I just loved what you said about how your work is engaging, you know, not only in translational work across different cultures, but also thinking about the slipperiness between, you know, material, vernacular, and philosophical, which I thought was done really well, you know, when we think about salt as like really material object in many ways, but also an embodiment of, you know, what it means to think about the ruptures of multiculturalism that, you know, I also really identified with as an immigrant woman. And when we think about toleration, that actually brings us to pungent, because you talk about the films The Crow and Lost Caution to talk about limitation of toleration. And I've actually watched Lost Caution before, back in long, long time ago. And I also really identify with your analysis as well, but, you know, didn't look at it with that framework. So I was really interested to read the analysis. Can you tell us more about, you know, pungent bodies and limitation of toleration?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so pungency is when these gaps that we've been talking about in liberal multiculturalism become unbearable and too transgressive, too much, right? And so both of these films, The Crow and Lost Caution, they reveal in quite different ways the intolerance of racialized pungent bodies or colonized bodies. And so, you know, pungency is like a bad smell, right? It emits from one body and enters another against their will, even. And it highlights the porosity between bodies when the divisions become thin and shaky. On the other hand, pungency, like spiciness, is something that we tolerate and perhaps will enjoy with a bit of time, with a bit of training. And so this also relates back to what I say about vulgarity being rooted in temporality, that the vulgar analytic lets us think about time. But in the case of Lust Caution, we see these colonized, well, Tong Wei's character is a spy for the resistance group in China, resisting against the Japanese occupation, and we see her, you know, give her body to this, you know, this collaborator in the puppet government, and we see them transgress what are acceptable hospitable boundaries in these darker genres, and particularly in how these films deal with sexuality. We see that there's an excessive desire that also becomes encoded in deviant sexual proclivities. But I am connecting sort of the subjugated status of being racialized and being colonized with this kind of transgressive desire, desirous nature. And so I find it really useful to think with a scholar, Braca Ettinger, who's a kind of feminist post-Lacanian, who's thinking about the womb space as this indeterminate space prior to division, where it's about relations without relating. So there is no there is no division between the I or the other. And this is what we see in a film like Lust Caution and The Crow, where these Asian female bodies have become overly incorporated to the point of sexual deviation, whether it's deviation that's traitorous against one's nation, like in Lust Caution, or in The Crow, you know, Bai Ling's character has a love affair with her half brother. So it's the incestuous, right, is again about border crossing. It's pungent, it's unacceptable, it's morally kind of unacceptable, right? So so all these kinds of traces of deviant sexuality and connect back with the racialized pungency of their bodies, which is marked in different ways. You know, Bai Ling's body is marked by tattoos and this lipstick that is drawn clownishly around her mouth. You know, you can see that it exceeds the boundaries of her mouth. And that sort of visually mocks her accented English and malapropisms. And similarly with Joan Chen, who uses a lot of malapropisms in Twin Peaks in the Salty chapter, misuse of language is also this kind of seen as this minor transgression, this pungent act here as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And I think this chapter was like really helpful for me in thinking about, because, you know, my research thinks about, colonialism in Korea, regarding like Japan. So this is like a historical, but I'm thinking kind of about like the rhetoric of that Japan, of that Japanese colonial government incorporated in order to create like one body with the Koreans. But then there was also the simultaneous, rejection of, the dirty, in a way pungent, Korean bodies. And I think that in many ways, this chapter was just, really helpful to think about, coloniality in new, ways through taste, which was really, really interesting. And, you also talk about this too, with your chapter on sweet, and how, that, really disrupts neocolonial desire. Can you tell us more about, the concept of sajiao, as well as how, sweet feminine beauty disrupts neocolonial desire?
Sure. Yes, I'm glad we're returning to sajiao because I had it in my mind and now we're circling back. So the chapter on sweet is a return to more ambivalent performances of Chinese femininity and what I frame as soft sweet. So thinking about materiality and lateral connections between matter. This chapter deals with feminine sweetness and routes us through the romance narratives where we're looking at the ways in which Taiwanese women stars Shu Qi and Vivian Xu have performed in these cross-strait, that is mainland Taiwanese romance films, that are trying to, that endorse the ideology of One China and try to make that ideology sweet to its audience, right? And that is the political notion that Taiwan is part of China, and that one day, Taiwan should be reunified with China. That's the kind of One China ideology that is being proposed and pushed in these films. And so what I see in these films, though, is a reluctance, is the ways in which through the minor act, again, we see that these women, even though they seem compliant and the narrative will force a kind of compliance upon them, a tenderizing of the body and of desire, that I see through various ways that this is disrupted. So in a film like The Knot, Vivian Xu engages in this flirtation style or this kind of, it's often connected with flirtation, sajiao, but it's also meant to connote other forms of behavior related to essentially acting like a spoiled child. So yeah, throwing tantrums, pouting, public pouting. This is a term that I think about right away in the introduction of the book because it's a point of cultural mistranslation in a lot of ways. It is accepted among those who are familiar with this performance in Chinese contexts. It becomes a form of flirtation, right? It summons the partner to play along. Both parties understand that there is a layer of artifice and exaggeration. And it's a quite comedic, it's not meant to be comedic, but to any outsider, it can be quite comedic. It's a form of adult romantic play. But Vivian Xu uses this, she draws on this in her role here, where she essentially is pouting, stomping her feet, crying, in a way that is not supposed to be there. It's quite subversive because the film is really serious. It's this epic drama about her romance with a mainland communist member. But she undoes the seriousness of this film's politics, right? By through this Sajiao, it is, you know, she's producing these crocodile tears, and she's her acting is so almost Brechtian that it allows us then to reject the film's kind of hardcore ideology with this sweet, soft, you know, feminine performance, overly sweet and soft. And I love what you also said earlier about kawaii being also about the grotesque, because Sian Nai also writes about, you know, cute aggressivity. And this is what I locate here in Vivian Hsu's performance, that there's this aggressive edge to the cuteness, to the hyper cuteness here. And so If You Are the One as well is about a sweetness of the feminine, of Taiwanese femininity that is, in her case, becomes depression. It's so sweet. It becomes it has a depressive quality. But you see that the melancholy is this resistance, is a form of resisting the advances of this mainland Chinese suitor. And so, yeah, both of these, it's about, in the end, this kind of depression, it's about grieving for this loss, and this in Freudian melancholic conception, it's internalizing that loss of the object, which is, you know, the Taiwanese nation in some ways, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and yeah, I really love that, and how and in a way it's a simultaneous movement that like depoliticizes undoes like the politics, as you put it so well. But it is also about acknowledging that loss, which I also really loved as well. Like this like indeterminacy, like, you know, which I think is like the concept that I'm, you know, coming to like, you know, think about more and more as something that is really important to, you know, think about like feminist politics as well as, you know, the representational aspect of it. And, you know, speaking of, in a way, cultural or culturally misfit humor, I wanted to move on to Ellie Wong, and you know, like, I loved your analysis, especially because I think it really allowed me to kind of like put into words like what I felt, you know, when I was watching it. Like, I, you know, personally love her show, and I was just really struck by like how many times, you know, she talks about shit, and you know, you theorize that, which was just really, really cool. So I wondered whether you could tell us more about, you know, Wong and how her vulgar abject performance disrupt, quote, hegemony conceptualization of gender, time, and work.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, in some ways, this was the most, you know, most fun chapter to write because I could discuss comedy at last. I'm also a big fan of Ellie Wong. I love that she wears the abject as a badge of honor. Her comedy is very much about the vulgar Asian body. She's half Chinese. And she rehabilitates the leaky Asian female body as something to revere in and to delight in this carnivalesque way, you know, in Bakhtin's conception, which I earlier mentioned, through profanity, obscenity, and embracing the body, the body and its like earthly qualities and behaviors. So by delighting in eating and defecating, she really enjoys the pleasures of the body in all its unproductive glory. And this is of course compounded by her jokes of being holding this anti-work position. You know, she has this facetious critique of feminism, right? Because she's like, I don't think we should work. Of course, we know that that's sort of that's a kind of ironic statement because we know she's working so hard. So the joke functions on a different level. But what she is showing us is that we can find complex forms of empowerment in our racial sexualization as Asian American subjects and in our kind of vulgar bodies. And it's the way that she sort of manages and produces these angry affects that I find most charismatic, you know, like in traditional Chinese medicine, sour, and this brings us back to the sour modality. The sour rebalances the liver where anger is stored. So sourness is the kind of cultural antidote. And the sour here for me, the racial sour, is offbeat, is quirky. And in being anti-work, finds a rhythm, another rhythm that goes off of work time, that goes off of clock time. And in that itself, it holds a kind of anti-capitalist promise. And we can think about like laughter and the collective atmosphere that laughter induces. It almost, you know, syncopates inhalation and exhalation when we think about the beats of comedy and the punchline and these kinds of things. So there's something, there's a kind of atmospheric promise of a collective that's produced through comedy, right? That could be anti-work, unproductive, just kind of about enjoyment and pleasure.
Yeah. Oh, which I, you know, with the pressing, you know, requirement from capitalist society all around us, requiring us to work, like, which I also just like really appreciated. And yeah, in her most recent show, she talks about, you know, like, she's like, I do not want equal pay, I want equal pleasure, which I thought was actually quite stunningly done.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then this is actually reminding me of the recent book that came out called Anti-Suing Squad by Preeti Sharma and other feminist scholars as well as activists that actually really talk about, you know, how all of these aunties, you know, the immigrant women, you know, produce the mask, you know, kind of like in their homes in order to care, and in a way how even though they were working so hard, it was actually quite anti-capitalist because, you know, it was about like unpaid labor, but kind of subverting that to kind of show how they care about the community, as well as they actually also emphasize laughter as well, like the materiality of laughter and how even though it was a really hard time and precarious time for them, you know, they embodied that labor of care with laughter, you know, with sardonic laughter about how negligent the, you know, state was. So yeah, I thought it was, you know, also like a really cool connection to labor scholarship as well. Yeah, but I've taken up a lot of your time, so I wanted to conclude the show with the final question. It's the traditional NBN question on, you know, your next book project, but then I also saw that, you know, you're super cool and you also direct and write, you know, like shorts and film. So I wanted to ask you, you know, like, what is your next like book project or like a creative project that you're working on right now?
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, I think so. I'm working on several different projects at the moment. One of them is veering more into a sort of mysterious terrain. So in chapter 2, I use this term disknowledge. Catherine Eggert uses it to talk about alchemical imaginings and disknowledge, but I argue that it is precisely through partially being able to disavow a bad idea that only strengthens the attachment to the bad idea. And so I want to pursue even more so the idea of bad ideas or abject epistemologies by thinking about occultic ways of knowing. So I'm actually looking at quite, you know, some might think really bizarre modes of knowledge like astrological thinking, witchcraft, what people have written about dreams in a kind of alchemical psychological way, or in a kind of alternate kind of way of thinking that these are so outside of what we deem acceptable in a kind of dominant academic mode of thinking, that I'm really drawn to why they're so compelling and how we can think about occultic knowledges and abject epistemologies in thinking about cinema itself as putting spells upon us, as generating a kind of dream worlds. And so this is really quite nascent, but it's about bringing in even more sort of subjugated knowledges to thinking about the ontologies of cinema. And then that, I think, is somehow connected, but it seems that it's this is a tenuous connection for now. But the other project is to look at surveillance aesthetics in art cinema and global art cinemas, and to think about ways of looking circumscribed within new technologies and what that means in a philosophical sense. Like, how does seeing a long shot, a long take with a steady cam, how can we think about, you know, stalking, the phenomenon of stalking or dreaming alongside, or dreaming and thinking in new ways because of these new technological ways of seeing. So that, I know, and I understand that sounds a bit kind of abstract and poetic for now, but those are just some ideas. And for creative projects, I am working on a feature script. I've made a couple short films that have circulated on the festival circuits, but this feature is tentatively called Mongoloids, and it's a punk coming of age story. I guess it's semi autobiographical, but I'm interested in genres. It's also a horror film, so I'm interested in sort of archetypes and horrors and how they connect with collective imaginations and build out from shared myths. So
Oh, that sounds amazing. And how, like, horror is in many ways also subjugated as well. Like, it's like, because I guess horror genre often play on the racialized, like the figure of racialized and like subjugated people to invoke this like white fear. So that sounds really interesting. I really want to watch it. And so both projects sound really helpful, you know, like wonderful. And like, I just love your focus on subjugated knowledges. But about surveillance camera, I actually wonder whether you find this useful. So actually in Korea, the feminist movement like really gained traction, because for a while, like having a surveillance, like secret camera, like in the public bathroom to kind of watch women like shit and poop, or really dominant in Korea for a while. So this was an impetus for like a national like feminist movement against it, you know, because it's like obviously really horrific. But kind of like also like thinking about like body like access, and like I feel like people still need to analyze like why so many men were putting this like secret camera in the public bathroom, you know, what kind of like satisfaction or pleasure were they kind of gaining from this? I don't know if that really relates to your research, but I think, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon that maybe you can like check out as well. Yeah,
that's really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, this was such a generative conversation, and I'm really excited for the audience to, you know, get your book, because it was such a fun and like really insightful read. And I want to thank you again for being on this show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure to speak with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mila. I'll see you.